Thanks. Hey, Terry, thank you so much for a great introduction. I'm a little flattered there. My name is Todd Barber, and I'm chairman of the Reef Ball Foundation. And for the last 25 years, we've been going around the world restoring coral reefs and making all kind of reef habitat. It's been... Go ahead. Well, you know, it was a lot of things in my life that led me to start this business, but it started when I was a child. My father used to take us to the Cayman Islands for family vacations every year. And we went to the same little resort on the north side of the Cayman Islands. And when I was 13, I learned how to scuba dive. I didn't have anybody to dive with, so I would just take the tank and swim out a couple hundred yards off the resort and sit on the bottom. And I used to watch this one little coral head, because that was all that was sort of right there next to my resort. And I just watched it like kids watch an aquarium, and I watched the coral grow every year when it came back and saw the same fish. And I just really fell in love with this one little tiny coral head. And then later on in life, I went off to college, and I was on a boat sailing with my father across from Miami to Bimini. And we got caught in Hurricane Gilbert, and 60-foot waves for 18 hours. I thought I was gonna die. We finally made it across. There was a lot of drama to that story, but we survived it. But that same storm wiped out that little coral reef in the Cayman Islands. And so when I went back there, I was having a rum runner with my dad on Rum Point, and we were starting to get a little bit woozy there. And he said, you know, I'm an inventor, and I think I know how we could put your little reef back. He said, there's a fringing reef outside, so we couldn't get anything big. But you know, you have these little fish tanks when you were in the apartment, I see, that you really like growing corals on. What if we put out something like concrete, and then you planted it just like you do your aquarium and make it come back? And I said, well, you could never get that much concrete out. He said, well, what if we float it out? He said, concrete doesn't float. He says, well, what if you took a beach ball and then you just pack concrete all around it, and you put some holes in it like you have a nut rock in your fish tank, and you roll it down the beach, and then when we get out to where that spot was, we'll take your dive knife and we'll pop the beach ball, and it'll go to the bottom, and then you can go gather up your corals and do what you do in your tanks. And I said, that's a crazy idea, Dad. And that's about all that happened of it for another 5 years. I went off to become a management consultant and traveled the country, helping with sales management plans and all kind of stuff for my professional business. And then one day, my dad got bumped up to first class, and he was sitting next to the guy who was the head of the state of Florida's artificial reef program. And at the time, all we were doing was tires and various types of materials of opportunity. Yeah, that's back then in the day, that's all anybody knew about. Nobody thought about designing something specifically to put down. They just thought about what we had left over to, you know, put in for the fish, because we had seen if you put stuff down, fish will congregate around it. So we had some ideas that this might work. Well, my dad was telling this guy about the idea, and the guy said, you know, well, I could probably get you a permit to do that. And so my dad called me up and said, son, how would you like to make that crazy reef ball? I met a guy on a plane, and he said he could get you a site in West Palm Beach. I said, no, Dad, you know, I'm working 200 hours a week. I fly 5 days a week. I really don't have time for any of this kind of stuff. He said, son, you're working too hard. I'll pay for it. You go on vacation. And I said, party. So I got my friends from college together, and we all drove down to Florida and arrived, and we built the first three reef balls that weekend. And of course, it took a lot of time and retooling to get that idea to where it is today. It took us another year to figure out the science and the concrete chemistry and how to really get permits properly and such. But we've been growing ever since, and we now have over 1 million reef balls in 70 countries around the world. So, you know, we've literally restored about 0.5% of the amount of coral reefs that have been destroyed in my lifetime. Now, So if you took all the coral reefs in the world and you put them all together, they would only be about the size of the state of South Carolina. So we think about all how big the oceans are, but the places where we really have reefs are that small. And if you take in my lifetime, I'm about 50 years old now. So in the last 50 years, we've lost about 30% of those reefs. So you take the size of South Carolina and you shrink it by 30%, and that's what we've lost. And Reef Ball Foundation has put back 0.5% of the shrunken area. So we've put back about a county, and we've lost about a third of the state. But that's quite a bit of progress if you think about how much resources we all get from coral reefs. And people go on vacations, we get our fish from coral reefs, we get beach protection from coral reefs, we get human medicines from coral reefs. There's a lot of biodiversity that goes on in coral reefs, that, little critters that people never even heard of, but that's really where there's a lot of hope for the future for different types of medicines. And right now they've got a great new possible opiate that doesn't get people addicted, that comes from the toxin in a pufferfish, for example. So there's ways that you can, you know, inject it into your back and it stops the pain without having to you know, yep, different kinds of stuff. Yeah, see, a reef ball is really just using Mother Nature to help herself. We're making habitat. So if you take an average reef ball, which is, we make them 11 different sizes, from, you know, as big as a car all the way down to a basketball. But you take an average size one, which is about, oh, I don't know, 3 feet wide and 4 foot tall. And that size, you put one of these balls down, and it costs us about $180, produces about 400 pounds of marine biomass per year. Well, marine biomass isn't all fish. Some of it's algae and other stuff. About 30% of it is stuff that humans would use, like fish or lobster or crabs or oysters, things that you would eat in your culinary kitchen. And then the rest of it is stuff that goes into the system that those creatures eat so that they can grow. So, and it does that year after year, and a reef ball continues to get bigger and bigger, so it starts producing more and more as the reef grows around it. So it increases from 400 pounds to more. And we design these things with no rebar, nothing to break down, so that it's basically a permanent reef. So that for the next 500 years, you're creating 20,000 pounds of fish with that one reef ball. And you think about how many people we're putting on this planet, we need more food, and particularly healthy seafood and it's caught in a sustainable way. So as long as you're taking less than, you know, your what you're growing out of adding habitat, you're keeping the system in balance. And so it's not only a way to create food, it's also a way to balance what we're taking. And it's very simple. It's no different than when we, you know, if we cut down all the forests, then you don't have any birds. You're gonna have to have some place for the birds to have a nest. It's the same thing for fish. They gotta have a place to grow up and have their babies so that we can eat some of them and we can leave some of them to have more babies. Yeah, and it's not only a species that is sort of underrepresented. I mean, one of the reasons why I felt compelled to do this, because, you know, when I learned to dive, you know, when I was 13 years old, there weren't too many divers. And I was one of the first people to go under and witness and watched the decline of some of the reefs. I watched the Florida Keys reefs decline. As I traveled, I was lucky enough to travel the world quite a bit, and still am fortunate to have personally been in 60 countries. And I get to see these things, and I get to see them change, but it also makes me the messenger, because I know not everybody can dive, not everybody can snorkel. In fact, probably only 2% of the world is ever going to get a chance to really see a reef up close and personal in person. They might see it at their local aquarium, they might see it on television, and I really do believe there's a lot of burden on particularly high definition underwater videographers today to get out there and show people how important these things are, because once you see them, they're just amazing. I mean, they're the most beautiful habitats in the world. You can not describe the color and the beauties, especially with old photography techniques like you can start to see now. We're just now starting to see where some of this high definition stuff is getting close, but you'll still never get the glitter of the color of a butterfly fish when it iridescence, or when a jellyfish lights up at night and changes colors on you, or seeing a That's right. And you know, coral reefs are, it's a very obvious thing to me what's happening, but you know, I used to grow orchids too. And orchids are kind of like a coral reef. You got to put them on the right side of the plant. You got to put them, you know, in the right amount of water, in the right sunlight, the right temperatures. And each one has a little niche that can make it bloom and make it beautiful. Corals are the same way. They've evolved over millions of years, and they learn to get little tiny niches. And there's only one thing you can't do, and that is change up their environment too much, too quickly, because they have to adapt. And the one thing that humans are really, really good at is changing things. So it's not just one thing that we're doing. We have to learn to adapt to the new world with things changing, and that means providing some habitat back. It's not all about coral. A lot of what I do is about marine habitat, and that means maybe the water quality is too poor right now to support coral. But that doesn't mean that by putting a reef ball down, you wouldn't still have some soft corals and fish and things that still depended on it. So it's kind of like an artificial tree in some places, until we can get the water quality back. And until we can... you know, I travel the world, and there are places where they still use dynamite for fishing. And, you know, for me to take that dynamite away from somebody, and he looks at me and he's got a small kid that's malnutrition, I got to look back and say, here's a reef ball. Now keep fishing that and teach them how. And now they've got food every day, because when they blew up the reef, then they had to move down the street to the next place because there was nothing left. So we've got to learn that too. And that is, you know, it's more than just recreational fishing in some countries. Every place is on a different level of the learning curve. And it's not just coral reefs. We have oyster reefs, we have kelp reefs, we have rocky reefs, we have canyons and ledge reefs. Just about anywhere there's water, hard bottom, particularly salt water or estuarine water, provides habitat for a wide range of species, just like trees do on Earth. I always come back to trying to explain to things the way they learned it from their grandparents, but what I do is almost as simple as what my grandmother did when she would take a cutting off of a tomato plant and plant it to make another garden. I do the same thing with coral. I'll take a clipping off of a coral, I'll plant it and grow a new coral and leave the old coral growing too, you know. And so it's a lot of very simple stuff. If we all were underwater and we could see what I could see, it would be pretty obvious that what I'm doing is not that special. I'm just doing what my grandma taught me to do with good care of a garden. Just doing it in a new environment. Well, and to that point, one of the things that I've always done with the Reef Ball Foundation is focus on the positive. There's a lot of people out there telling us about what we're doing wrong. I always try to go around the world and make sure that everybody does things just a little better. I don't try to push for wholesale change, but hey, instead of using dynamite today, let's just stop using that and let's just use a fish hook. And then yet here in the States, I might say, let's look at slot limits to allow some of the biggest fish to live. Everywhere you go, you want to do just a little bit better than you've been doing before. But reef balls do give people a chance to say, hey, I can make a difference. I can go do something positive. I don't have to sit and listen to all the bad things we're doing. I can go out and make a difference. So that's what's exciting about reef balls. I do see a lot of people around the world that really enjoy getting together and helping other people without necessarily having to focus on all the negatives that are happening in our life. If you start dwelling on the negative, obviously there's another negative issue every day and people's attentions are getting short. So I try to dwell on, let's all just keep changing a little bit for the better all of our lives, wherever we go, whenever we do anything. Let's teach other people something a little bit better. For you, make them just a little bit better chef. Teach them just a little bit more about making someone else's life. You know, open your mind, try a different food, try a different flavor. Those are the things we're going to need to adapt for the future. We may not be able to eat the same things as we did in the past. So, you know, we had to give up buffalo. Well, you know, as a diver, the most exciting thing to me was never the sharks and the turtles and the manatees. It was always the little tiny, tiny, tiny stuff. Because, I mean, even today, I've spent more than 10,000 hours underwater. I can go to just about any place in the world, set on the bottom, and if I look close enough, I will see something I've never seen before. That's pretty cool. That's, you know, it was kind of... You know, when I was a kid, my grandpa used to take me out in the woods to go camping, and I'd sit down and do the same thing. But eventually I got to where I pretty much knew most of the plants and stuff. But to this day, I still love going out in the woods because I might see a new mushroom I've never seen. But in the ocean, it's almost guaranteed. Now, if I just look at the big stuff, they start to get the same. And a lot of people that get into it, you know, I like to go see sharks because it's dangerous. I mean, all of us that were alive in 1976 remember Jaws and the thrill we got about being scared by sharks and how we feel brave. But one of the things I don't believe in is in feeding of marine fish. I believe in watching and observing them. I have a... Yeah, we've got a colleague that did artificial reefs like I do, and he was taking his daughter, who was 11 years old, for a snorkel in Cozumel. And he lost his finger to a barracuda and found out that the dive master had regularly been feeding that same barracuda hot dogs. So, you know, and that was right in front of his daughter. His daughter to this day won't get back in the water. I mean, she's been traumatized for life. And, you know, that's the kind of thing we don't think about is that these animals also have teeth and, you know, they may look, you know, very calm, but you get around their babies and you do stupid things and they can be dangerous. It's very safe in the sea if you don't spearfish or feed fish. And if you choose to do those activities, just be prepared that it's not as safe of an activity anymore. I think I've had that exact same experience. Martin Neals, yep. Yeah. I absolutely love octopus. I mean, and they are just amazing little critters. We actually have a method for creating octopus homes for the smaller octopus, not the giant ones. We could probably do the same thing for the giants. But they taught us this in Mexico. This is how a lot of reef ball grows, is that we teach people how to make reef balls, and then they teach us back how to make them better locally. So what they did in Mexico is they take a Coke bottle, and they turn it upside down, and they put it inside of the reef ball with concrete all around it, and leave opening just the top of the entrance to the bottle. And they leave it at an angle so that the bottle won't fill up with sand. And then when they deploy the reef ball, they put some water in there to make sure it's not filled with air. And the female octopus will come in and she lays her eggs on the inside of the bottle. You can't let any light get to it. It's got to be smooth. And she covers up the entrance with her body and she protects her babies until they're big enough to leave. And you'll see it when you dive, and they only put one per reef ball because you can't have two octopus in the same habitat. They spread out. But you know they work because you can swim around the reef balls, and in front of every one of those little holes will be a pile of shells where she's gone out grabbed an oyster or a mollusk, brought it back, and she ate it and throws it right in front of her lair. And they're just crazy intelligent. And we've got a big one that was 2 years old, a giant octopus that took up residence in a reef ball in British Columbia. And it comes out and just plays with the divers every time they come in and recognizes them. And not for food, it has this thing, the old-fashioned cameras that would make the mechanical clicks when we used to dive with them. It just would love to listen to those. So it'd come out just to hear your camera. So. You know, I'm asked that question a lot, and I always have to qualify this with is what my goal was on that particular traveling trip. I have places that when I go for the best food, I have places that I go for the best skiing, I got places I go for the best diving, I got places I go for the most cultural diversity or experience or friends. So I would say that there's not been any place I've been that I did not like. I really have always been able to take back the best of what's there. But you have to travel with an open mind, you know. There really is no one place that's best. There's no Shangri-La on the perfect place. And in fact, you know, most places, if you go back two or three times, you might get a different experience. And I've gone places with that, you know, I got sick there one time, so I had a bad experience. But I go back a second time, and wow, it's incredible. Look at what I missed this first time. So it's what you. Yep, it's yeah, well, I'm a lot like you. I like to travel for culinary interests because I really enjoy food too. Probably as much as you. I can't cook it as well as you, but I really enjoy trying different things. But what I tend to do is go to a place and I'll eat very conservatively at the beginning of my trip and stick to, you know, stuff that's well cooked and yucky, so to speak. And then once I get my work done, I tend to be just like you and dive into anything I can. And the one thing I learned, sometimes you'll get sick, but then if I travel back to the same place, you usually won't get sick a second time. So I think your body, now the exception of that is, I think if you have to take, at least in my experience, if you have to take a course of antibiotics because you get really sick here, it's almost like you have to start all over again because you have to recondition your stomach because you've started over. I do. That's and like when we do reef ball trips, we always try to plan them for our volunteers in particular, but even our professional crews. We like to keep trips to 10 days or less if we're going across the big ocean, and you know, maybe 7 days or less if we're going to the Caribbean. And the reason why we do that is that you can get people through just about anything for 10 days. So if you get someplace and they just don't have the food you like, fine, go fishing and go do something else. And you can always, I would tell people, you can almost always get an egg and a piece of toast, you know, if you can't get what you want in an area, you know. And you can almost always, if you can't drink the water, then grab a beer, I tell people, you know. I mean, there's it's in a can, right? So even though maybe you're a teetotaler, don't normally drink, fine, make an exception. You're on a vacation and find the best in the place that you're at. Well, and the other thing is, you know, I got sick one time in Argentina, so sick I didn't know what day it was. But you know what? I made friends. I found out people that were really there to take care of me. Can't make in any other experience. So you turn tragedy into opportunity, and then you turn those best trips into great memories. And if you're not creating a memory for your life, then you're wasting your day.
Hi, everybody. We'll be right back. Got to take a quick break for a commercial. That's what keeps us going. Those wonderful advertisements. It's not too long. We'll be right back.
And I don't... Well, and particularly if you go to a lot of the, if you travel remotely, you get to islands where you have very, very small cultures. And I've been to islands that I haven't been to for 15 years, and I go back and literally everybody remembers my name. And, you know, I remember their faces, but I have forgotten their names because we see so many people. Yeah, you know where the largest coral reef in the world is? In Trinidad and Tobago. Not in Tobago, in Trinidad. I went down there one time, and this is the only time I've ever not recommended reef balls for a community. Went down to this little community. It was a town where they had a lot of oil production offshore, a very poor town, and the oil company wanted me to come down and make some reef balls because they were gonna drill something and they thought it would make the fishermen happy. So we went there and started diving around just the bay, and there was all this incredible structure, but there was no fish. And then we talked to the fishermen, and they say, well, we have to go out 80 miles because our nets get caught. So we say, well, we're gonna go down and dive and we'll find a place to put the reef balls. They said, well, there's not really any divers here because it's just loaded with these Portuguese man-o-wars. But we can get you some tanks from the city. It'll take a couple days. They got us some tanks, and we went out in this little small boat. Jellyfish everywhere. The water looked murky and kind of almost like a river. And I said, okay, I got to go diving. And the head of my coral team, he says, I'm not getting in that water. But one of the young interns says, I'll go. I love diving. And I said, okay, you and I are going. And so we went down the anchor line, scared to death of these jellyfish. And all of a sudden, the water became clear 10 feet down. And below it was the most incredible coral reef. And it turns out that coral reef goes all the way to the Amazon River. The Amazon River floats out across the top of it. And there's a complete untouched coral reef there that was so unbelievable. There was no space, no sand, no place to build a reef ball. It was constant reef. Now it was weird. It was not a coral reef like you would normally expect with corals. It was, it's a type of calcifying algae that we normally see underneath rocks that has grown for years, and it grows these caverns and structures. But it's the same fish that you see here in the Gulf of Mexico, grouper and snapper, and it's just incredible. They've since now documented it with submarines and you know, are starting to explore it because there's really no practical way to get to it. But that's the kind of weirdness and craziness you can get in this world right in plain sight, and that gives me hope too. Well, that was just Well, we honestly do know that this works. It's been working for 25 years, and the only way it's going to make a real positive difference in the world is by us teaching each other how to take care of the planet. And I have one way that we know how to address one problem, and it's, I feel it's my duty to teach other people to, so they can teach more people and we can keep going with this. And hopefully humanity will do the same thing with a lot of our other problems too, is when we find a solution that works, we replicate it and we pass it on and we share it. And that's what makes us human, I think. None of us would know how to garden if our grandmas hadn't taught us how to be better farmers. And when I was born, they were all worried about everybody being out of food by now. And somehow or another, our farmers have figured out how to make more food. And you know, I know I've always had food in my stomach. That's not true of everybody in the world, but mostly it's been a distribution problem, not a lack of food. You know, so we know how to farm it. We just sometimes don't know how to get those farm goods to people. That's a good problem to have versus the other way around of not having enough. And yes. Well, I've always thought of the FADS, fish tracking devices, as being a form of fishing gear. I do not consider them any way attracting a fish to an area doesn't produce a fish. And it's just like you said, it's no different than fishing gear. If that makes fishing easier, then that's making fishing easier. We still have to catch fish. I differentiate that completely with something that attracts fish and provides habitat for fish. Like you said, we're not asking them to make carry if they come to a reef that's been built. You know, it's a very complex thing because, you know, we're still, you know, hunters gatherers in a lot of our heart of hearts. I mean, we still, you know, we don't now hunt cattle, we raise them, but we still, you know, hunt and enjoy hunting, and we fish and we enjoy fishing, and there's recreational fishing and then there's commercial fishing. And I'm a personal believer that recreational fishing is unbelievably important, because for every dollar that someone spends on that fish, they're putting $250 in the community, versus a commercial fish, which is just taking that fish out and not getting much back. And worse, the one rule you could make and you would save fisheries would just be, if you catch a fish, no bycatch. I mean, if you just made one rule, if you're gonna catch something, you catch it and you eat it. Well, my grandpa taught me when I was a kid as a hunter, you know, if you shoot a squirrel, you're going to eat squirrel tonight, whether you want to or not, you know, and that it was a very reasonable, it is a finite resource, and we're learning more and more about how finite it is. But it also is one of our largest. You know, 90% of the planet has water on it, someplace or another. And you know, there's fish that live in streams and lakes and estuaries and oceans, and you know, it's a big part of our planet. So we got to make sure that we manage it well as we continue to grow as a species and eat more and more fish. You know, things have got to stay in balance. We learned a long time ago on land that we had to either regulate hunting or start farming. We're just now learning how to farm the oceans. We're starting to get there, but we're in the very beginning stages of understanding how to do that economically and without causing disease and without causing problems. And there's going to be headaches in that. We've already seen some of the headaches in some of the shrimp farms that they're having now. I mean, there's good shrimp farms and bad shrimp farms. Yeah, there's just, you know, it's like any other kind of farming. There's a lot of waste involved, and you've got to be able to process that waste. And you can't, the temptation in the ocean is just let it, dilution take care of the problem. But dilution is not always the solution to pollution, as they used to say. You got to be a little smarter than that. We do. They're very useful in coastal estuary systems that are connected to the ocean. They are much more difficult to predict how well they would be when you start to get to small ponds, because what I basically tell people is every little pond has its own little ecosystem. One's got one kind of fish, one's got one kind of crayfish, and habitat may or may not be the limitation on that. So in freshwater, some fish don't need reefs. They actually just wander around, and they need you know, trees and limbs and grasses at the edge of the thing as their form of habitat. So we have to be a little more careful. We don't just wholesale recommend it. We call all freshwater closed systems as experimental, and we let people try. And we had very good success in like Great Lake systems and big large systems that have a lot more diversity. But it's a little less predictable and a little you know, farm that might only have catfish in it. And you know, maybe catfish don't need any more habitat. They need more food, or maybe they need more species. Yeah, I don't recommend tires anywhere. We've had such bad experiences with tires over the years, not only in the coral, for example, doesn't like to grow on them, but the harder part is that when they're underwater, they, especially salt water, they're almost neutral. So they bounce around and float around in the smallest storm and can do more damage, especially to coral reefs. People don't realize that when things are underwater, they weigh half as much. You know, when you start doing the mathematics, anything that's might be a little bit heavy on land is, you know, you can move it around with your finger underwater. I can move tires around all day long. That's not normally a good thing for creating habitat, because you never know where it's going to end up, on the beach instead of where you put it down, and you know, bouncing across corals as a storm goes through. That's not really, you know, smart management. So boy, you know, the hope I never happens again is, as anybody who's traveled, I've had a few situations where my life was threatened. One time with a knife in a hotel room. You know, there's always safety issues. Well, you know, it was a resort area. I won't name the island name because I don't want to, you know, discourage tourism. But, you know, I left the door open. I was a very trusting person because I had my scuba gear out there, you know, hanging on the balcony to dry. And someone jumped in and said, you know, they wanted my cash. And I stood up and said, no, because I was still asleep and I wasn't thinking. And luckily, I had left my wallet on the floor, and he saw it, picked it up, and he ran down the beach and he threw all my cards and credit cards out, kept all the cash, and went to the police the next day and said, sorry, we have a rule with them around here. If they don't take anything but cash, they don't hurt anybody. We don't. You might have been there once yourself. Oh boy, my favorite food. You know, the I really love complex, spicy foods. The more complexity and flavors, I would say, probably some of the dishes I had in Thailand blew my mind away. And I remember having one time there, they brought these big prawns. They were, a prawn is basically a gigantic shrimp. And they baked it. Yep, and they baked it in a pineapple, and they had a lot of spices in it, and the pineapple just made the, it just all blended together with a sweetness, with the, I don't even know how to explain it. It was better than a lobster. I mean, it just really came together right. And yep. I was really into, I don't know if you've ever, I'm sure you probably have, but there's the Encyclopedia of Scientific Cooking. It's basically a big old thick thing. And I really enjoyed one chapter in that was how to make the perfect hamburger. And boy, I spent a lot of time trying to. Doing it just right is quite an art to get, you know, you can kind of pre-cook it and you got to caramelize the outside. And, you know, for me, all the pepper. Yeah, that's what it's all about. I mean, I've really been exploring a lot of spices lately, and it's really interesting how the combinations, you start to get intuitive with it, but there's no one book that's written that's perfect. You know, you got to go with your own senses and your own tastes, and what's available that day is a big thing. One of the things I did learn from traveling, never be that American tourist that says, "I insist." I remember one time in the Philippines insisting on a burger. And the chef kept saying, "No, no, no, fresh fish, fresh fish. No, I wanted a burger." That was the one time I got food poisoning. Like you, and later, you know, the translator finally told me, he said, he was trying to tell you that that burger's been in the freezer for 20 years and nobody ever eats it this year. Yeah, you know, they had one in there, but so he, you know, he felt obliged to make it for you because you insisted, but you know, sometimes you just, you know, yeah. That's a very good, and also look at what your chef is putting on the table. A great trick for traveling, I walk around, half the time you can't read the menu, and you look and you say, you know, take your waiter and say, "I want one of those and one of those." And then you smell, that's what the locals are eating. You already see that it looks good to you. That's a way better way than looking on the menu. And, you know, I remember one time my mom was traveling with us, and we were in Mexico. We couldn't read the menu, so mom just picked the most expensive thing on the menu. Well, that was cow tongue, and it came out so textured tough. Again, something that broke. I don't think that these people had any experience of making it. It was one of those, they just had it on the menu because it was... I will disagree with you because I just explored that in making an Indian dish, and there is a curry, but it is a plant, It's not the same curry that we have. We have a mixture of spice. Yep, and the curry leaves. Next. It's not the same. Yeah, exactly not. But I really enjoyed playing with the curry leaves. It's they add a neat flavor that Western cooking doesn't have, and that's what I've. It is, and you can. It pretty much can only be used fresh, in my experience with it so far. I've got it grown out here on the deck right now, and I'm waiting for it to get a little bit bigger because you got to keep taking leaves off of it. But I love the unexpected. I love the non-common spices. I love part of travel is finding spices that you've probably sometimes smelt them before, but sometimes you get that one that like, I've never smelt that before, and I don't know how to cook with that. Then that opens up a whole new chance to go back with your old recipes and could I tweak this in back into something? How could I use that in my cooking? And that's the best thing about travel is leaving the bad things that you don't like and bringing back the best of whatever it's a different way of greeting and nodding your head instead of shaking hands. That might be a really good thing for the world to think about right now. I like it how they do it in Thailand. You know, they put, looks like they're praying to you when they say hello or greet you. You know, that's kind of a neat little custom and bringing back the best of their spices, the best of their food, the best of their traditions. And leaving you go to places where they do things the way you don't think they should be done or a bad example, and leaving that there. Yep. Yep. Well, right now we are building reef balls on the east coast of Florida to protect the beach from erosion, which is a nice project. We've got the one I'm most excited about is going to be coming up in Borneo. Borneo is in Malaysia. It's a beautiful little island, and we have done a bunch. It's a very diverse area above the water as well as below the water. It's in the coral triangle, so there's a lot more diversity there in coral reefs, which is always exciting to me. That means I can see even more new things I don't normally see. But we've been doing projects there for 20 years, and they just make me so proud when I look at a reef ball there. I can't even tell it's a reef ball anymore. It's a coral reef. And they've had such success, they decided to, over the next 5 years, they're going to make 15,000 reef balls. The government just said, hey, stupid, this works. Let's replicate it, and they're going in a big way to really ramp up and do one of the largest projects. They're using the largest size reef balls we got, so 15,000 is a lot. It's ambitious, and it's creating a lot of local jobs, which is also good for the economy. It's something positive for people to look at, and I know that in another 15 years we're going to have another reef that's built that's going to be huge and be just as productive as the ones that are there now with reef balls. So that one's really exciting to me. We've got we're always doing projects around the world because basically we give people molds, we give people the training, and then they keep going. So every time I go someplace, that project starts, and almost every project I've ever done, it continues to grow because people see it works. And then the next community will start doing it, and it just keeps multiplying. It's kind of like it's just simple math, it works. And so we go, we train, and it keeps going. So I'm starting to get to the point now where I'm actually getting invited back to places that I did before and to document what was going on. I'm so used to diving on, a sandy bottom before there's a reef that it's kind of nice now to go back and see stuff that we've done before. But we're constantly doing neat stuff. There's going to be some interesting changes going on the next couple of months with the coronavirus. We're having to figure out how to train people online instead of in person. That's more difficult because, as you know, as a chef, it's really hard for someone to test your cooking skills if they can't smell it and taste it. I mean, just looking at a cooking show is one thing, but actually sitting down to a meal that you've prepared. Yeah, it's hands-on learning. It's really, really hard. I mean, I teach people, like, when they're mixing the concrete, I'm sure it's very similar to when you teach somebody how to mix batter. There's not just one recipe that works. It's different days. Some days our sand is wet, some days it's not. How much yeast did you get started with? You know, you got to watch it. You got to poke it and say, okay, now it's ready to be baked off. And you can't teach that by recipe, but you can take an apprentice. And when you're cooking together, show them enough times to say, yeah, when it presses just like this and it pops back out, now's the time to cook the bread. That's kind of what we're trying to do. Yeah, we have to do a lot with concrete. We have to teach people to do concrete differently than they're used to making houses with it, because we have to make the pH the same as the ocean. If you make regular concrete poorly, you have a lot of unreacted concrete, and that can cause problems with the coral not being able to settle and grow in the reef balls. So we have to teach really, really high practices, like using water reducers so that they don't add too much water to the concrete, mixing it really well. Most importantly, we use an admixture called microsilica, which locks up the calcium hydroxide that is the byproduct of the concrete reaction to turn it into a second kind of glue. So it makes it more like a ceramic. And teaching us how to do this without you doing things like, you build a house, you put iron rebar in it for structure, right? That makes it stronger. Well, if you did that in the sea, then in about 15 to 30 years, the rebar rusts and it expands and it blows the concrete apart and your reef falls apart. So remember what I was saying, you're gonna make 400 pounds of fish this year and it's gonna be 500 next year. Now you're just cut up to the knees. Now 20 years from now, when you finally get a reef, it all falls apart. You have to have a very long-term thought process. It's kind of like planting a future Japanese oak tree that's gonna take 500 years to be sculpted into this beautiful garden tree. You may be planting something now for the next generation. And I learned. The best place to find us. Best place to find us is www.reefball.org, and that'll direct you into all of our different sub businesses. We do things with cremated remains, and for beach protection, and for under docks, and for long seawalls, and coral reef restoration, planting of red mangrove trees. We've grown out into a whole lot of different subspecialty fields from, you know, just doing this everywhere and learning what we can learn. So finding us on the web is easiest. And because we work with so many different cultures, it's often, if there's different languages involved, it's easy with a computer now to translate from one language to another language. And, now that you've heard of reef balls, you'll start seeing us everywhere. It's like, if you haven't heard of reef balls, Yeah. Once you get it in your mind and you understand what we're doing, there's probably a reef ball near just about where any of your listeners are today. If you pulled up a map, it wouldn't be a reef ball very far away from you. And that's right. What's neat too is that we're a global movement, and I think fish don't know borders. And when I travel, I try to, like you said, be polite and leave my manners behind and learn from what's there. We still all live in the same world. We all face the same problems, whether it be coronavirus or the coral reefs being destroyed. All together, though, if we all work together, we can overcome all kind of problems and make this world a better place. And that's what it's all about, is let's make some memories and make the world a better place and enjoy it. That's absolutely right. And you know what? I answer all my emails directly, reefball@reefball.com. Anybody is welcome to email me, and I will get an answer to them. I'll direct you off to the right place in the organization. We've got 400 people around the world that may end up fielding the specific question they have, but we're here to share knowledge. And I don't care if it's, on Facebook, on the World Wide Web, standing up at a high school and saying hello and telling people, what we're here to do is spread knowledge, and any way we can do that is great. And I appreciate being on the podcast too. It's another good way of getting information out to people who otherwise might not be able to learn about us. And Terry, an honor for me too. And let me drop in that there's some really, really neat, exciting stuff coming about sometime next month. And I want to talk to you again about that. I can't talk about it now, but a lot of your listeners are going to be hearing a lot more about Reef Ball over the coming months, and some very exciting news. So I'll just leave that little teaser there out for the future. We'll have to leave some stuff in the air, Terry.